back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Socks, the Catholic Book Blogger, here on Red Fox Media. And today we have Heather King as our guest. She's a Catholic convert. She's the author of several books, among them Parched, Redeemed, Sure to Flame, Poor Baby, and Stumble, Virtue, Vice, and the Space Between. She writes a weekly column on arts and culture for The Tidings, lives in Los Angeles, and blogs at her blog, heather-king.com. Most recently, she's written the book Holy Desperation, Praying as Your Life Depends on It from Loyola Press. Welcome to the show, Heather King.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. And I want to, you know, dive right in here and take a look at this book. And the first thing I have to say is you really laid yourself bare in this one. And I'm grabbing a quote from your blog here where you say, "I'm an ex-barfly Catholic convert and I'm proud. I write, speak, give retreats, edit, and clean bathrooms." So tell us a little bit about where you came from that gave you the basis and the insight to write Holy Desperation.
Well, as I said, I grew up on the coast of New Hampshire, big family, 8 kids, not Catholic. We were Protestant, blue collar. My father was a bricklayer and my mother was a housewife. I'm going to be 65 this week. So that will situate child of the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And wonderful, hardworking, intelligent family who loved nature and books and music, and we have alcoholism. Not my parents didn't have the disease, but both sides of the family deeply affected. I am an alcoholic, and I started drinking when I was 13. Promising kid, straight A student, athletic. And as soon as I started drinking, it became my primary purpose. And so it took me out for 20 years, during which I graduated from college, graduated from law school somehow, very driven, but no powerless over alcohol, which turned out to be a huge, huge gift because it brought me into right relation with the universe. I was brought to my knees by a dark power that was greater than me, and it led me at last to sort of turn to the power of truth and light that shines in the darkness. So, you know, my family sent me off to rehab when I was 35 or so, and I found a fellowship of recovering alcoholics and drunks, and worked as a lawyer, got married, worked as a time for a lawyer in LA, and had a big crisis of vocation because I knew in my heart I was meant to be a writer. And so I quit, ended up coming into the church, big search, seeking, and ended up quitting the job, giving up the money, and coming into the church and beginning to write in the mid 90s. And so that's kind of how my journey with Christ and the church began.
Okay, there's a lot to consume there in that story. The thing you mentioned there, I think it's pretty wild, is, you know, you said two things. You were able to power through it and still be a lawyer, your alcoholism, and you also used the word gift. Obviously, at the time, that was not revealed to you until after you went through your conversion process. But looking back on it, how much of a gift was the alcoholism, in a sense?
Well, yeah, of course I didn't see it as a gift at the time, and I've been sober 30 years now. And I'm still an alcoholic, even though I haven't had a drink one day at a time. I think alcoholism is really who knows? It's a mystery that science and medicine have not been able to find a cure for. It seems to me it's a spiritual malady, and the solution, weirdly, is also spiritual, which just infuriates, I think, and stymies the medical profession, which feels like everything can be fixed with a pill, surgery, intervention. And so in that sense, you know, because the solution and the lifting of the obsession to drink all those years ago when I was at rehab, a 30-day rehab, I experienced, in retrospect, I saw something had happened to me, meaning the lifting of this horrible obsession. Something had happened to me that could not happen by any kind of rational, logical means. There was no scientific, I wasn't fixed by a pill, by an injection, by a surgery, by money, all the stuff that our culture tells us. Those are the solutions of our culture. I mean, it was an act, and I understood it even back then as an act of unmerited mercy. Mm-hmm. And that was really the gratitude that stemmed from that, the gratitude of, oh, if there is a God, he's not keeping score. I have been welcomed back to the human table, no questions asked. I didn't have to give a good account of myself. And that's the story of the prodigal son / daughter. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens when you're not shamed, as Christ doesn't do, he doesn't shame us, he doesn't reproach us. He does the crazy, no, in fact, here's a beautiful cloak and a pair of sandals. You sit at the head of the table. And what that does is makes you, with every fiber of your being, want to rise to the occasion, to sit up straighter, to take a responsibility for your past, present, and future actions, and to contribute, to participate, to get yourself in shape, to welcome the next person. Mm-hmm. And so it's a complete shift of your point of view, your whole orientation toward the universe changes from victim. Oh, because when you're a drunk, oh, I mean, you're suffering, but it's kind of neurotic suffering. And you're also imposing suffering on all the people around you, but you mm-hmm. just can't see your way out of it. It's a victim mentality. Well, it was for me. And then you go from that to sort of on your knees, the true orientation of the follower of Christ, humility, obedience, deep gratitude, and also awe, this deep need to, or desire to worship. So that's what alcoholism brought me to. And therefore, I mean, it brought me into right relation with reality. And mm-hmm. what could be a greater, there could be no greater gift. So,
right.
And it keeps me there too, because, you know, I still have to, I mean, clearly, in a way, I have to work on, do the inner work and the prayer and examination of conscience more than ever as I get older. So,
you know, listening to you, you echo a friend of mine who has had the same fight. He was an alcoholic as well, recovered. And it's interesting, for those of us listening today, I think anybody can talk about alcoholism, but you don't truly understand what it is unless you've experienced it. And he talks about, as you do in the book as well, hitting rock bottom. You know, science can try mm-hmm. and fix that. They can try and give you a pill, and obviously there's nothing they can do about it. They've been unable to come up with that, as you said. What's it mm-hmm. like when you hit rock bottom? Because you've been there, he's been there. Can you tell us what that's like?
Well, the first thing about it, I think, is the incredible existential loneliness of alcoholism in general. But my bottom, I had graduated from law school and passed the bar. I was living in this sort of loft, which is a very glorified name. It was really a single room occupancy kind of semi-skid row hotel. And I was drinking in the morning, like going to bars. I'd go to this old men's bar in North Station in Boston at, like, I can't remember whether the bar opened at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., but I would be there and would drink my sea breezes and sort of come home and pass out at like 10 a.m. I mean, it was unbelievably isolating. And meanwhile, I had this whole life of books. I mean, I would be reading when I was not so hungover, I couldn't even read, but I would be reading Henry James and Emily Dickinson and Dostoevsky and Kafka. So I had this whole, and those books really, really kept me alive, I think, in a sense. So the deep, deep loneliness and the, as we say, incomprehensible demoralization is, I think, like, is a phrase that sort of describes beautifully incomprehensible demoralization. I mean, you can't imagine living without a drink, and you can't imagine continuing to drink the way that you do, but you just cannot see your way out. And I, as you say, if you don't have alcoholism, I think it's almost, I mean, I've patiently described the phenomenon, the mm-hmm. craving and the obsession of alcoholism to someone who's not an alcoholic, and they'll listen patiently. And then at the end they go, oh yeah, I could have been an alcoholic when I was in college, but I realized it was causing me trouble and I just stopped. And you just want to scream and say, no, you don't get it. If you right. could stop, you wouldn't be an alcoholic. No, that is not alcoholism. So it's, you know, you're in the grip of something that is greater than you, and you're in this horrible, horrible inner conflict, because you know on some level that you're throwing away your birthright, but you can't stop. And in a way, you don't, I can't describe it. It takes your will and your desire and just warps them. So even though you kind of want to stop, you don't really want to stop. It's like that. It's so, but you know, my own bottom was, I mean, I had graduated from law school and passed the bar, mm-hmm. Massachusetts bar, and I was completely unable to function. I waitressed my whole drinking, quote, career, and I was getting fired from crappy waitressing jobs because I would come in at 10, 11 a.m. just wasted, like in a blackout. So I was unemployable, was covered with bruises. And my family, who loved me and supported me, they finally had an intervention for me. So it wasn't even an intervention, I think, kind of brings your bottom to your attention. Mm-hmm. And my family, like many of our families, and especially we have Irish roots, you know, it's kind of no one talks directly to each other. We all sort of talk behind each other's backs. And there was the elephant in the room, and my family got together and basically, that's what an intervention is. They basically say, we notice the way you drink and it's affecting us. It's honesty. Nothing is more gospel based than honesty. No one was more honest than Christ, who called a spade a spade, said, let's stay awake. Let's get up off our mats and walk. Do you want to be healed? And that was really what I was invited to. So, but the bottom was, and it went on, really, I was probably in the bottom for years, deeply, deeply lonely, hanging out in bars, all the things that you can imagine, a single woman in the bars and looking for love, and just unbelievably degrading and lonely. Hmm. And that is still, you know, that place, I don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door. And I mean, I'm not ashamed of that. It's partly why I say, sort of tongue-in-cheek in the description that you read of my blog, oh, I'm a ex-barfly and I'm proud. I mean, I get a kick out of this. That's another way of saying with St. Paul, I boast of my weakness. Mm-hmm. I don't boast of, say, being a woman. I'm a woman and I'm on the hyper alert for you discriminating against me. It's like I don't have any hand in my being a woman. I think it's a beautiful thing that I celebrate, but I mean, I didn't, like, thank you, God. I don't, like, I can't be proud of, I'm humbled. I'm humbled right. to be a human being, to be alive, to be a sober alcoholic. And so, because all glory to God, everything points to him, not to me. My identity is not in being a recovering alcoholic. It's not in being a woman. It's in, or many of the other, it's not even in being a writer, which is deep, deep in my heart, but it's my identity is in Christ. And that's why, that's what we quote boast of, that with all my fallenness and flaws, still I've been welcomed back to the table.
That's an awesome message, and we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. We're here today with Heather King, and we'll be right back. here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Cox, the Catholic book blogger. Today, we're here with Heather King, the author of Holy Desperation, Praying as If Your Life Depends on It, from Iowa Press. Heather and I were talking about her recovery from alcoholism and how she hit rock bottom. And Heather, I think the most important thing I want to point out about your book is that in it, you're not preaching to people in this book. You're taking a real world, down in the trenches approach to the faith. You have hit rock bottom. You experienced, you reached out and found the welcoming hand of God while you were down there. And I just want to give you kudos for that. And who all is your target audience? I imagine it's more than just, you know, just recovering addicts from whatever they're addicted to. I could see value in the book reading it without having that experience in my life. And we'll get into how you address prayer in a few minutes. But if you give us your thoughts on who your target audience is.
I have a target. I think my target audience is just is a human being like me who is hungering for meaning, thirsting for righteousness, trying to find his or her way through this culture that is so based on power, property, prestige, mm-hmm. so saturated with lies, so, full of various kinds of idols. I mean, we're just tempted all the time. Mm-hmm. And whatever, money, yeah, the bling, all of it.
Right.
So I think it's just a fellow human being like me who kind of has a sense of humor, who's searching. And I wanted my book to... Actually, my acquisitions editor at Loyola, who approached me with the idea, talked about some of his own kids who had fallen away from the church. And he said, I want this to be a book that a lapsed Catholic could read, that someone who's mad at the church could read, someone who has no interest in Catholicism could read. And that's always, I think, been... I mean, Catholicism, to be Catholic to me is to be deeply, deeply, truly human. And so that's who all my work is for. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a target on it. I'm not trying to impart a positive message even. I'm spontaneously trying to share my experience, strength, and crazy hope. So, and I think the proof of... The great thing about my work, or one great thing, is I hear from a wide, wide, wide spectrum of people. A lot of them are priests, nuns, third order, I mean, are religious folk, and then, or I should say some of them, a fair number, but all kinds of people, who are lapsed, people who may have... no interest, people who are Jewish, people who are atheist, just hungering human beings. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm doing, that's when I know, oh, maybe I'm actually kind of doing my job. Mm-hmm. And I think that's who our message, our quote message, or whatever you want to call it, our witness should appeal to. If we're targeting an audience, I feel like we're marketers, and we all know how Christ felt about marketers in mm-hmm. the temple. My goal has never been to sell a lot of books. It's been to, like, sort of Matthew 25. I want to pour out how this is my way of doing to the least of these. So I'm always just want to be obedient to my gifts and to my heart, and then let the chips fall where they may.
There you go. And it's a great message. You're reaching out, in essence, to people in the pews and people not in the pews who aren't connected, who feel disengaged. And it's a powerful book, and I highly recommend it. I'm going to grab another quote from your book here as we segue into my next topic, and that is the following quote. The essence of prayer consists in doing what most of us have never done before and that no human being does unless we are utterly, completely out of ideas, and that is to acknowledge defeat and ask for help. Kneeling, our heads are close to our hearts. Kneeling, we feel our exhaustion. Kneeling, we're the height of children. When did you realize that you had run out of ideas?
Well, again, I think having actually graduated from law school with honors and passing the Massachusetts bar on the first try and being utterly, in other words, even in the depths of my alcoholism, being able to sort of compete, if that's what you want to call it, or succeed right. on a worldly level on paper and being yeah. completely unable to function as a human being in any arena. So I think that was, again, I think the intervention of my family and when I was at rehab sort of invited me to see, wow, as smart as I think I am, as sensitive, as tormented, as well-read, all of it, as charming, as funny, whatever I thought I had, none of that is availing me anything. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to live. I don't know how to really function as any kind of joyful or contributing human being in the midst of suffering. I love Mother Teresa's phrase, joyful participation in the sorrows of the world.
Nice.
I was 34, 35 years old. I was just utterly clueless. And mm-hmm. so to just admit that and quit trying to fight it and quit trying to use alcohol as the solution. And again, it was just all given to me as a grace to see, oh, this alcohol, which I persisted in thinking was my lifeline, was actually killing me. And so somehow just to turn and see, oh, maybe there's another way for me. But I had to admit first, mm-hmm. utter defeat. Mm-hmm. My way is not working. Right. And once you admit that, then everything becomes it just becomes easy in a way. Not that there's not a huge, long, lifelong pilgrimage ahead, but you're fighting the right battle. You're not fighting a losing battle. So
right.
That was kind of when I saw, I am out of my idea of like managing and controlling my drinking to make it work for me. That was my basic. That was like my right. one idea, and it was not working.
Okay. So essentially what I see your book as, it's a book about recognizing our daily sufferings and recognizing that they have purpose, and then in turn uniting them to God to make a positive from them. So what you're telling us is not necessarily that the addiction's a problem that you're facing from day to day. It can be anything. Some people might find to one person what may be minor, maybe major to someone else that they're having a problem with. So how do we go about doing that? How do we, you've already said, you know, first we have to admit it. We have to admit there's a problem that we're facing. But how do we go through this sequence to take that suffering and turn it into a positive?
Right. And thank you for emphasizing that alcoholism just happened to be the thing that brought me to my knees. But clearly, a book about prayer is universal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, well, that is what prayer is, I think, is opening our hearts to God and getting really, really allowing ourselves to be totally honest with him and with ourselves about what goes on in my heart on any given day. I mean, one way to break that down is resentments, fears, and secrets/, which subheading sex stuff. I mean, and really those are the three: resentments, fears, secrets. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of, I have a priest friend who says that's looking at those three areas is a wonderful way to prepare yourself for confession, because you can be cash register honest. You're not stealing money, for instance, or committing adultery, but you can be saturated, have the blackest heart. You can be very, very, very far from pure of heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real stuff of the Gospels. Christ says it. You may not be committing adultery, but what's going on in your, what are you coveting of your neighbors? How are you spending in this culture? How are we spending our time? I mean, if you're watching television 5 hours a day, whatever, CNN, Fox News, direct reality shows, violence, softcore porn. I mean, this is not, this is not, how can we possibly be with Christ, who spent his time healing people, walking about, observing nature, seeing how everything around, the hills, the mulberry bush, the mustard seed, everything is a reflection of God. That's what we're called to. That's what part of what it means to stay awake. I mean, I think our responsibility is to cultivate. It's a very disciplined, while wearing it like a loose garment, but it's a very disciplined existence. So that would be one great question to ask ourselves. How are we spending our time?
Mm-hmm.
And what are my thoughts consumed with during the day? And we all have them, resentments at neighbors, family members, friends, employers, coworkers. We have to work on that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because how can we be spreading the gospel to the ends of the earth if we're consumed with jealousy or rage? And so that, to me, is the real gospel journey. And how can we be spreading the gospel if we're consumed with fear? What if I don't make as much money? What if my daughter is a drug addict? What if my son doesn't get into Notre Dame? I mean, fill in the blank. We all have our own version.
Right.
And Christ knew the human heart, and he's all about forget that. Your Father knows what you need before you ask him. I think maybe the short answer is we let get in touch with really the deepest desire of our hearts. What is that? I think it's usually so clouded by our desire to sort of get ahead or look good in the eyes of our neighbors that we may have lost sight of what that desire is. And again, I think because my alcoholism, and then sort of in some sense making it in the world, because I did work as a Beverly Hills lawyer for a time and just saw it, for me anyway, the emptiness and the how that didn't begin to address mm-hmm. the deepest desires of my heart. And so for me, the question became, can I follow this desire of my heart to write and make enough money to live? That, of course, was a huge and can I overcome my fear of failing, my fear of the unknown? I mean, I was 40 years old when I started. So I think those are the questions we get to ask ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have a God. You have to have a power. I mean, that's when we get on our knees and say, God, give me the strength, the courage, walk with me. Because that is God's will. I'm sure of it.
Yep.
To follow the deepest passion of our hearts.
Indeed. With that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Bedbox Media with Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger, and my guest today, Heather King. So far, Heather, and I want to backtrack just a little bit. Two things we mentioned in that last segment, and something that sparked in my mind while you were speaking. First was you brought up the comment, Stay Awake, and that is the title of one of the chapters in your book, Chapter 5, and I'm going to quote from that. You said, God's call to us isn't so much primarily to be good as to come awake, for in coming awake, we'll naturally want to be good, whole, and true. We'll naturally want to throw all caution aside and embark on a lifelong pilgrimage. How do we know we're not making it all up? The universe presses back. Awesome quote. Loved it. I think that's an important thing. That's an important thing for all of us, no matter what our stage is in life, whether we have a faith life or we don't, is especially once you come to that faith life, it's stay awake. There's sometimes the potential of reverting back to old habits, just becoming lax in our faith. I experienced a reversion in my own life before I started blogging. And had it not been for that reversion, you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking today. But, mm-hmm. You know, we all have that. So what are some keys for people to stay awake? Is it habitual? You know, this prayer life, do we just institute it? You know, what do they need to do to stay awake?
Well, again, I think it's like to get in touch with our deepest desires and then to order our life to that. So if your deepest desire is to come awake and stay awake in Christ, you are naturally going to order your day, your time, your money, how you make it, how you spend it. Everything, and that's why prayer is the ground of that. I mean, this is not some little frolic of our own that we make up. It's not self-actualization, which is what our culture tells us. It's a deep, I think, grounding ourselves, first of all, in the Gospels. I'm a big, I don't want to say fan, that's not the word, friend of, admirer of Thérèse of Lisieux. I wrote a book about walking with her spirituality, and we led very, very different lives. Thérèse died very young, mm-hmm. lifelong virgin, sort of never did anything truly wrong. So but her spirituality, I think, is very, very authentic, very gentle. It's all about trusting God, throwing ourselves into the arms of the Father. And, yes, and this kind of staying awake. She herself was not, she's one of only four women that have been made a doctor of the church, and she had no special theology, no special education. She, in fact, her spiritual / religious reading was almost exclusively the Gospels. I think that's key, and it was the same for me. I really came to Christ through just reading the New Testament, reading the four Gospels, really, mm-hmm. just cold, without any, just working as a Beverly Hills lawyer, brought my childhood Bible to work with me. I was so hungering and thirsting. Where is the truth? What master am I going to serve in this culture, in this world? I read the Gospels, and the person, capital P, of Christ, simply revealed itself to me as the living water that it is. And so I think every morning I pray the office, and then I read that day's liturgy. And that, I think, to be, and I reflect on it, and I suppose in some loose way reflect upon it throughout the day. Mm-hmm. I write for Magnificat too, which is, as people may know, a daily,
yes,
monthly magazine of literature. And so I've gotten, that gives me an extra opportunity to reflect upon the Gospels and upon the saints and upon notable Catholics, the spirituality of. So that, I think the closer we get to Christ, and the other way to do that, of course, is to stay very, very close to the Eucharist. you can hear the couch in my throat. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what Christ left us, his body, his blood, and his words. And So to me, I have never, ever frittered away my time reading the virulent argument that passes for so much of Catholic culture. Who cares? I want to go to the Gospels. I want to hear the word of Christ and rise remotely to the insane challenge of trying to live that out. So I think that's how we, and the more, the closer you get and the more you hear his voice, which is so true and so arrow straight and of such unparalleled, unmitigated integrity. And then I think we can be, it helps you to discriminate against that voice, or I should say between that voice and the voices of the people who are not prophets in and out of the church, that are out for themselves and not out to glorify God. But I think it's our own, the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The culture, and this is always true, it was just as true in Christ's time as it is now. If we look to the world, it's just empty, it's false, it's vanity, it's passing. And so I think you have to, it's a gift to just be sort of sickened by the falsity and emptiness of that. And mm-hmm. and then your heart searches for something else, something true, something eternal. It's up to us. As he says, narrow is the gate. I mean, it's you have to be willing to look like a complete fool. Christ loved people who were willing. Look at the leper, the one out of the ten who separated himself, threw himself. Thank you. Right? The guy in the sycamore tree. Is it Zacchaeus who mm-hmm. climbs the sycamore tree? Oh, the blind man, please help me. Help me regain my sight. The people who are willing to look like fools, who came up from the crowd, not to say, hey, buy my book that's all about me, or buy my like marketing Catholic book, but to say, please help me, cleanse me. If you don't have that desire, I don't know what to say to you. You know, I mean, you're going to like follow the rules, but I think you won't come fully awake and alive. So
right.
It's a gift to be so broken that you really have nowhere else to turn.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's all about, you mentioned this in the last segment too. You talk about, you know, what, and you alluded to it here, filling your time. What do you fill your time with? You know, I've read this, I've written a couple articles about it on Catholic Stand. It's that God-shaped hole. You know, everybody's trying to fill that hole with something. And usually it's the bling of this world, and that's the wrong path. And again, it takes getting to that point and realizing that none of this is making me happy, and turning to the Gospels and reading the Gospels and understanding the message of Jesus and filling that hole with that is when we get our true satisfaction in life. And I think your book does a good job of leading people in that direction. Through your own life experience and telling people about it. So the main focus of the book, essentially, is a deep dive into practical tools to bring people's lives back in focus, to right the ship, to fill that God-shaped hole. So as you went through the steps of returning to the church, what tools did you find yourself turning to? Obviously, you just spoke to reading the Gospels. Was there any other, as you progressed along your journey, can you tell us a little about what that progression consisted of?
Well, I can say that, first of all, the prayer, and that was always easy for me. I think part of what I want to say in this book is prayer. I think a lot of people look at prayer as this kind of obligatory, sterile, boring, I'll go to Mass on Sunday and say the rosary. And it's just, there's nothing, it doesn't have the kingdom of God at the center of it, the kingdom of God that is like yeast. And so part of what I want to say is there's no technique to prayer, as far as I know, or in my experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just a cry of the heart. But it's interesting in the sense that not that you hear voices or it's a roller, but it's interesting in that I think the closer we allow ourselves to approach Christ, we do feel the universe pressing back. We do see a change in our actions, our thoughts and our actions. For instance, not having to, I mean, even I surprise myself sometimes by not having to set someone straight or not having to, in so many words, explain how important my life is and how busy I am and that's why I can't, whatever. You know, it's like kind of taking a back seat a bit, and I have some of those actions. There's a chapter of that in the book, but I think what happened was my prayer took root as I began to look at. I mean, I did a moral inventory way before I came to the church about my resentments, my fears, my secret. I told them, and this is within the ambit of my fellowship of recovering alcoholics and addicts, who actually live by a very very high moral code, weirdly, that has to do with, listen, we can't afford to have resentments. We can't afford to have secrets because for us, we will drink again. And if we drink, we die. And so I was already very schooled in what is really a Catholic, what we would call examination of conscience. So I just began to incorporate all of that in my daily life. And then making amends for the wrongs that I had done, leaving aside the other person's fault. And this, again, is very gospel-based. Mm-hmm. Christ, who says, let's take the beam out of our own eye, and they will be equipped to take the mote out of our neighbor's eye. In other words, step up, go and sin no more, step up to the plate. If you've done someone wrong, even if you think they fired the first salvo, you go and you sincerely say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. How can I make it? How can I make us whole? You reconcile as best you can. So all of that, I think, led to my ability to the grace that I had to give up all this money I was making as a lawyer, making money for the first time in my life, by the way, and then to quit that job and follow my vocation. And that everything has really flowed from there. So my tools, such as they are their obedience. It's obedience. It's always, I've seen my vocation as obedience to my gifts, to this is my way that I can best serve Christ, and the work is his. So it's humility, it's obedience, it's discipline, there's a wonderful word. The word isn't coming to mind. It's like, chastity of the eyes, chastity of the ears, something like that. Chastity mm-hmm. isn't the word, but in other words, you watch yourself during the day. Okay, let's not spend 2 hours looking at how our political leaders are corrupt and substandard. Okay, you know, you get to spend maybe 10 minutes, probably like the really person in the beam would spend no time doing that, but you know, in other words, you keep a check on things, and therefore you're led to have way more time to do the things that you love. Mm-hmm. So for me, that includes taking a daily walk. I garden. I play the piano. I do read poetry. And we need a community, and that's another thing. We need a community, whether that community is your parish, whether it's your circle of recovering alcoholics, whether it's your family, I think it needs to go beyond our family. As Christ said, who are my mother and my brothers, those who do the work. I mean, our family is incredible. It is the backbone of everything, but we don't get to have our family be our God either. And Christ did not let his own family, as much as he adored his mother, treasured his mother, made her queen of heaven and earth, but he himself was willing to, I mean, his mother had to watch him mm-hmm. die on the cross. So mm-hmm. our family is not our God, and we're called to serve, who God gives to us. We don't get to handpick the people that we serve. Our work is for everyone. Our life is for everyone.
Right.
Right on.
So, yeah. So, okay. Custody of the eyes. That's the word. Custody
yes,
of the eyes.
There you
custody
go.
Of the, there of the you heart. Go. Yeah.
Okay.
Such a great. Yeah.
All
and
right.
You know, and we fail all the time.
All the time. So with that, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in our last segment and tie this all up. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger, and we'll be right back. Depends on it from Loyola Press. And Heather, we just started touching upon prayer a little bit last segment. One of the things you talk about in your book, you actually highlight two specific forms of prayer, shall we say, in your book. You talk about the divine office, the liturgy of the hours. Now, some people are very, shall we say, afraid of the liturgy of the hours. You know, I mean, how many ribbons can you possibly have in one book? What for tips can you give people who are, you know, fairly new or fairly afraid of the liturgy of the hours?
Well, I don't know if I ever have any tips. To me, it's always, I came to the liturgy of the hours because I went to a, and it may have been when I had, as I call it, my little bout with cancer back in 2000 or so, but I went to a retreat. Just a private retreat at a monastery nearby, St. Andrew's Abbey. I think that's when I somehow first became acquainted with the hours. I mean, I think everyone's heard of Vespers and Compline, but they don't really know. Anyway, I somehow realized, oh, they pray this way. And I wonder if, just normal, stumbling, pathetic lay people like me, you know, I actually thought, maybe I wasn't allowed to do it. And then I realized, I read about it and realized, no, the church invites all of the members of the faithful or anyone into this to pray the liturgy of the hours. And I just was so transfixed by the sort of beauty and the order. I like the order. I think the human heart very much craves sort of order and seasons and liturgical seasons and hours and a way to order the day. And so I read about it and I realized, you can buy, I think at first I bought the little shorter Christian prayer, which is a little kind of shorter one volume. And then I realized, you can go all out and get the 4-volume breviary, right? With the separate season, the red for Easter and the blue for, so I got the whole thing. And, you know, I'm not, listen, I figured it out. I mean, it's not super complicated. It's a 4-week cycle. But for me, I just loved the special. It's a way to really, I think, enter into the liturgical life of the church with the memorials and the feasts and the solemnities. And over time, you grow to look forward to them, right? August 28th, St. Augustine. Oh, Mary Magdalene, July, I think, 25th. I think it's coming up. Therese of Lisieux, October 1st, St. Francis, and then Lent, of course, and the big liturgical season, Lent, or rather the Easter season, the whole Easter season and Advent, become so meaningful. And so I would just say, go for it and just gently allow yourself, if you're drawn to it, to enter in. It's not for everyone. I know priests who would way rather, they're drawn to the rosary. They're not really drawn to the office. So in some sense, I suppose it's an individual thing, but it's been a big It's just a beautiful way for me to begin my day and enter into this alternate universe, a different life treasury. You can say the office of the dead. Your friend ODs and dies, which happens fairly frequently if you're in alcohol. I mean, I'll often go to my local chapel at St. Elizabeth's of Hungary. There's a grotto there. I just did that, actually, for a friend, a young woman who killed herself. See the office of the dead. Beautiful.
Now, another thing you brought up is Lectio Divina in the book. Again, I think that is an awesome practice to sit down with the scriptures and do. Can you give us a brief overview of what that is for those unfamiliar?
Well, again, I am so not... There are zillions more books by people who are sort of maybe more scholarly or kind of more formal. I mean, I didn't even realize I was doing Lectio Divina probably for a year. I just thought, oh, I can read that day's liturgy every day, the liturgy of the Mass, whether or not I go to Mass. Oh, wow, maybe I'll just do that. I'll just read the whole thing and sort of, and then I would, and Magnificat, which I was probably using from the beginning almost, has a, always has a beautiful reflection that day after, after the gospel. And so I would just kind of ponder, not out of any kind of, sort of obligation or even discipline, but just because what could be more interesting than the Gospels? And so I just found them so, my daily life would be reflected. I mean, I would get an insight. I would sometimes often get an answer to a conflict in my life through the Gospels. And so that to me has never been a chore. It's just, well, what else would you do but read that day's gospel reading and sort of reflect on it and ponder it. So for me, it's just a joy. So I would just invite people. That is to go to the source. Instead of reading your blog where some faction of the church is fighting with some other faction, or criticizing the Pope, or telling you need to vote this way or that. Like, go to the gospel. Go to the voice of Christ, the person of Christ.
Exactly. So I want to give you a couple.
Because,
go ahead.
You know, as a... Oh, go ahead.
No,
I was just going to say, I think about this a lot as a writer. I mean, what is the spiritual writing that has endured through the ages? It's never from people who are pissed off. Which so many people are, you know, to live in anger is automatic, prima facie, to be not in the Gospels. It's like, that's our job, to purify our heart. Not that we don't notice all the many, many things that are wrong in the world, the hideous oppression and injustice, but in order to effectively address that, we can't come from primarily a place of anger. Christ did not, he came from a place of love, which is something way, way more difficult, requires way more of the truly warrior-like heart. Mm-hmm. And so we go to the Gospels, that's the source.
Awesome. So Heather, I want to give you a couple minutes here to talk about your work. First, where can people find your latest book, Holy Desperation, Praying as If Your Life Depends on It?
Well, on our lovely neighborhood bookstore, Amazon, Loyola Press, I'm sure they sell it on their website. Maybe even in that would be wonderful, your little local church bookstore or religious bookstore would be great if they carried it. But all my books are readily available.
Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the other titles you've written that we haven't covered today, but I'd like to give people some exposure to your other work as well?
Oh, I have lots of books. Parched is my first book, Addiction as Spiritual Thirst, Down and Dirty. my childhood and my life in Boston in the bars, but also with a very deep subtext. I was already a convert at that point, so Redeemed is my sort of conversion memoir about the job, the Beverly Hills lawyer, and sort of the whole agonizing, how I came to quit that job and and pursue my vocation. Shirt of Flame, a year with Therese of Lisieux, sort of middle-aged, deep crisis. I'm sort of always in crisis of one kind or another, which I think is what it is to be a human being. Anyway, mm-hmm. that's my Therese of Lisieux book. Stumble is a collection of sort of essays. All my stuff is very slice of life, very incarnational, and that's based in my daily life. Loaded, Money and the Spirituality of Enough, really a book about what does it mean to be a follower of Christ, and what is our relationship to money? Deep, deep question.
Yeah.
Not that I've resolved it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Stripped is my cancer. I had cancer, chose to go against medical advice. I had breast cancer. I refused chemo and radiation, still alive 17 years later. Deep, and I got divorced in the aftermath. So a deep, not so much about, I mean, cancer was the hook the book is hung upon, but really also a book about deep prayer, about facing our mortality. And now I also have a book collected, my collected works from Magnificat up to about 3 years ago. That's a book, Holy Days and Gospel Reflections. And I also have a memoir coming out in the fall or early next year called
Awesome.
Famished, a food memoir.
Hmm.
So I'm just getting it all in, food, money, vocation. I have to write kind of like sex, you know, it's not sex so much, but this isn't my next book that I'm working on, a book about being a woman in the church. Deep, I have deep, deep thoughts and reflections and ideas and a take on that. The church, I am so not an angry woman in the church. To me, the culture hates and discriminates against women. The church does not.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's not been my experience. The church to me has helped heal my wounds, my deep sexual emotional wounds, and treasures me and has fostered me as a woman and as a human being. So I always say, listen, if you want to be a priest, go at it. Are we not all surrounded by people whose hearts are hemorrhaging, who are suffering,
yeah.
who are dying of loneliness, right? Go and be a priest, be a bridge, minister. To every woman, not just the ones who are in your little political, So wow. I am called out to be with all kinds of people who read different books than I do, who listen to different music, who may vote differently than I do. In Christ, there is no East or West, and rise to that challenge. We all get to be priests for sure.
Right on. So
in
Heather,
the deepest, you know, small p.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So I want to thank you for taking time
Go
out of your schedule.
It.
Yeah. I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule today and spending it with us. And everybody out there, go get Heather's books. As someone that reads books voraciously, as you well know from my work, Heather's book, Holy Desperation, I found to be a book that was very good because she talks to you, not at you, not down to you. It's very real world, gritty writing. Loved it. Good work, Heather. And thank you again for taking the time out of your schedule.
Thank you, Pete.
That's all we have for today.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, here on Redbox Media. And until next time, God bless.